this is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Brahma is in the studio as well, keeping up the positive vibes. But before we go any further, a huge thank you to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. Those dulcet tones easing you into your week here at RTR FM. He'll be back next Monday, but of course you can catch On The Record every weekday from 9 in the a.m. As I said, and as you should know if you're a regular listener, this is the Indie Media Show. It's all about the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs, kind of activist media, citizen journalism, that kind of thing. On today's show, we're going to be looking at the devastating floods over east that have affected New South Wales and Queensland, and particularly focusing on Lismore, where people there have lost so much as a result of these floods. Just a week ago, 9 Lismore residents dumped flood-affected household items outside Kirribilli House and called on Prime Minister Scott Morrison to act on climate change. The residents had been attempting to speak to the Prime Minister when he made a quick, what some might call, photo op visit to Lismore, but he nicked out the back door of the council chambers and they didn't get an opportunity to speak to him. So they went down to Kirribilli House last week to have a chat to the Prime Minister and try and talk to him about some of the issues they think are connected to the devastating floods. So a little later, we're going to be chatting to one of the people that went down to Kirribilli House to speak to the Prime Minister. It's Kate Stroud, to talk to her a bit about, you know, what's happening there and essentially what she believes the connections are between the floods and climate change. And I guess, you know, some of their views on what the government could be doing to actually address the pending and, you know, well, not even pending, the happening climate catastrophe that people there are experiencing. We're also going to be chatting to Mia Pepper from the Conservation Council of WA. Mia is the nuclear-free campaigner, and if you're a regular listener to this program, you probably recognise her name. She's been a long-time anti-nuclear activist for decades now and a regular contributor to this show. But we're speaking to her as WA's first uranium mine might unfortunately be getting off the ground. It's Vimy Resources' Mulga Rock project, who were one of the projects approved or that's got some extent of environmental approval by the former Liberal National Government here in WA before they were swiftly booted out of office. They've only got a little bit of time to get work happening for the project to go ahead. So we're going to be chatting to Mia about what the state of the Mulga Rock uranium mine is and what, I guess, you know, both Indigenous people on the ground there and also supporters and activists here and people who are concerned about uranium mining, what they're doing to try and stop this project. So a lot of, I guess, you know, important stories here on Indie Media this morning. A lot of reasons to keep it locked. You're on RTR FM 92.1. Now, folks over east who have been devastated by the floods that have affected New South Wales and Queensland, well, outside of just having to get together and make repairs and look after each other, especially in the absence of some government support in some areas, they're starting to really call on government to acknowledge and address the reality that these floods are connected to catastrophic climate change. Last week, exactly a week ago, a group of Lismore residents went down to Kirribilli to try and speak to Prime Minister Scott Morrison and encourage him to act on climate change. They also dumped a bunch of flood-affected household items outside Kirribilli House. One of those people that went down there to chat to Scott is, or ScoMo as he's sometimes referred, is Kate Stroud, who's a Lismore local, and she joins us now on the phone. Thanks very much for speaking to us this morning, Kate.
Such a pleasure, and I actually am born and bred in Perth, so I have that link with you also.
Fantastic. And now, obviously, you've now been living in Lismore, and you've been directly impacted on by these horrendous floods of some 14 metres. Before we get into what's happening there, and I believe you're also still very much in that reality and preparing for potential new floods at the moment, what we can speak to in a second, but just a week ago, a group of residents, frustrated, I guess, with the government, went down to Kirribilli House and dumped some flood-affected household items and so forth and tried to speak to the Prime Minister. Can I start by just getting you to tell us about that and why, you know, a group of you felt, you know, like necessary to make that drive and to try and confront our Prime Minister?
Sure. So it was driven from, you know, the extremely sluggish response that the government had to the initial rescue and it was a very on the ground first response. And then also, you know, Scott Morrison himself didn't address or, acknowledge us for the 9 days till it was day nine. And by that, you know, we're pretty in the mix of coming out the other side of the initial impact of the event itself. He also delayed in declaring it a natural disaster, which has some pretty huge effects for people in regards to insurances and access to, emergency relief funding and things like that. So he did come to Lismore and we tried to access him then and have a conversation. And unfortunately, he didn't want to face the townspeople, who, for the record, are passionate but peaceful. And he actually slipped in the back door of our council chambers and didn't come out at all. And I guess we thought it was very important for Australia to be aware that the curated media response that he had and that he published was absolutely in contrary to what was happening here. Like, he portrayed what he was doing to be hands-on and getting stuck in and helping the people, when in reality was he posed for some photos and, you know, threw us a couple of $1,000 and hoped that we'd go away.
Mm. I guess, yeah, on that, and you've already touched on it there, but it sounds as though, you know, outside of acknowledging sort of broader issues of climate change and some of the impacts that have occurred, it seems as though the government were very slow in acting to just directly support people on the ground. It's sort of been left up to just regular people to support each other, to engage in sort of mutual aid and help each other out there. Has that been the case? Has there been just a really sort of slow response from government and have people having, you know, have people had to sort of step in and support each other just due to the fact that there hasn't been the government support?
Yeah, absolutely. The response was completely community-led. One of my colleagues, she, after being rescued, had made a Facebook post about needing a boat. When she was on land and able to charge her device, she went back to that page and she had over 1,000 people in the community being like, we need a boat. Nobody's coming for us. You know, I personally spent 6 hours in my roof cavity waiting for emergency services that never came. So this woman actually, from that list, created a list that, had the address, how many people, their situation, whether they had children, whether, you know, they were fully bodily abled, if they were elderly, and physically handed it to the SES, and the SES gave that person the bureaucratic runaround about who can, you know, sign off on this, when she was just like, get in your boat. These people need saving now. Mm. And another side of that is another friend who is a pecan farmer. They ended up philanthropically funding 14 helicopters to get emergency food to cut-off communities. A lot of Indigenous communities received no government help at all, from what I can gather from my community. These helicopters were also saving people off their rooftops. In the backlash of that, they are finding themselves possibly in a lot of trouble because, you know, they went around these bureaucratic systems that are meant to be there to support and to help us in these crises. But in this instance, you know, they really slowed and hindered that response. And, you know, SES volunteers being turned away because of COVID vaccine mandates. So I guess we were drawing attention to these things. And whilst we understand that, you know, as a community, we know the ins and outs. We have direct communication with each other and we have access to one another that, like a government, would not. But the bureaucratic process needs to change because the immediate response outweighs those practices that are being put in that are supposed to protect us. But in this case, you know, it was fatal. People did die.
Kate, it really speaks to the reality that, you know, often when people talk about climate change, it sort of stays in that political realm in which, you know, you have people like Scott Morrison and others who very much sort of, I guess, politicize it by failing to address climate change or to properly, you know, I guess, acknowledge climate change in the case of, you know, some of the Liberal ministers. I mean, and it seems like this is the effect. This is the end result, is that if we had a government that was truly, you know, I guess, willing to act on climate change to avert climate catastrophe, not only would it perhaps mean, you know, more, I guess, on one end, more regulation of the fossil fuel companies and so forth, but it also means that policies, procedures, and you know, structures can be put in place to prepare for and react to these sorts of natural disasters that are surely only going to increase. Is that sort of at the heart of things here in terms of, you know, your experience that's really demonstrated that, you know, our government's lack of acknowledgement, lack of action on climate change is having real world impacts on people in these situations?
Absolutely. This is my second major flooding event in 5 years. And the one that was in 2017, typically, well, it can be described as a typical flood for this region. You know, this is a region that floods. But the difference from that flood to this flood was so accelerated in the amount of water. And it's so hard to, you know, verbally portray 2 extra metres of water. Like, it doesn't sound like a lot, but if you put it over the mass of the land, it's unfathomable. And yeah, as you say, without working with client scientists, without working with Indigenous elders who have, you know, looked after these lands for 60,000 plus years, who have this knowledge and this wisdom, I don't see how we can coexist in this environment, especially if we are doing things to accelerate it, like, you know, contributing to the climate change through the fossil fuels. And I don't know, I just feel like it, you know, government should have a duty of care, even though I know they've just recently fought through court to beat some children about that. But, you know, where does the responsibility stop? It's with them, and they have the power to make the changes that we need in the time frame that they need to happen, which is within this decade. Because this is only going to keep happening, it's only going to keep accelerating. And, you know, I don't wish this on anyone, but until it's in your own backyard, you don't understand.
You mentioned there, reference to, I guess, some of the members of the Student Strike for Climate. And, of course, in the recent years, we've seen huge mobilizations, particularly by young people trying to encourage our government to act on climate change, on the climate catastrophe. And you just said there, I guess, you know, for a lot of people, they don't act until it's in their backyard. I mean, for the local community there, do you think it's really brought home the realities of climate change? I mean, it almost seems insensitive to say that, because I imagine that's an obvious yes for the majority of people. But I do also understand that people are mobilising. There's been some, you know, attempts to at least get the local council to acknowledge, you know, the contributing factors of climate change in regard to these floods. But do you see a bit of a groundswell happening there in terms of people being more conscious and aware of climate change and trying to organise around it?
Yeah, look, I think that in this region we do have a majority cohort that are already on that perspective anyway and already acknowledged that before these events. If anything, that's only strengthened that perspective and that understanding. You know, unfortunately, we do actually have some council members who, in the first council meeting, actually tried to get all reference to climate change and natural disasters taken from the official documents of the Lismore City Council surrounding this event. So, you know, we do have a big majority of people who do understand and do see that, but unfortunately we are fighting the same sort of perspectives, even if they have themselves just experienced this event. So, yeah, it's a very tricky and frustrating one, but I suppose all we can keep doing is looking at the science and, you know, relaying the facts and the data to show the links between the two.
Just finally, Kate, I guess, you know, Australia is a big country, and for people over here, it sometimes seems really difficult to know what to do in terms of, I guess, expressing our solidarity or support for, you know, our friends and others, you know, just across the other side of the country. I mean, I, you know, obviously this is an issue that affects all of us, not just here in Australia, but particularly all around the world. But what do you suggest people can do in these times? I mean, I understand, you know, right now as you're speaking to us, you're preparing for more flooding in your home, in your community. What can people do here to both support the people of Lismore and, you know, flood-affected areas, but also just to really push our government to act on this issue?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you're right. We issued another moderate to major flood warning this afternoon. So, it's a bit full on here at the moment. I guess, the thing that you can do is to amplify our voices and to amplify the data and the facts that surround this, and to hopefully have impact on the people who do hold the privilege of having positions of power, and just put the pressure on, because I don't know that there's too much that can be done at the moment. You know, we just have to try and get ourselves back on track. But if you can join us in solidarity in that, in amplifying our voices, putting pressure on your local politicians, national and beyond, that they can't get away with this, and we've got to ensure that our voices are heard. So I think at this point that would be the most useful thing.
We've been speaking to Kate Stroud, who's a local Lismore member who has been organising around both, just supporting people there on the ground, but also in putting pressure on our government, particularly Scott Morrison, to actually acknowledge the reality of climate change and to take some action. Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning, Kate.
Such a pleasure. Have a lovely day.
And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1 with myself, Raymond Grenfell, and also Brahma in the studio, keeping up the positive vibes. Now, many of you are perhaps unaware that there is currently 4 proposed uranium mines that were given approval by the former Liberal National Government here in WA. One of those is still attempting to go ahead, and that is Vimy Resources' Mulgara Rock Mine. Environmental approvals gave Vimy Resources 5 years from December 16th, 2016 to begin work at the site in Mulgara Rock. To find out about this proposed uranium mine and the community who are organising in opposition to it, a little earlier today I had the opportunity to speak to the Conservation Council of Western Australia's nuclear-free campaigner, Mia Pepper, and I started by asking Mia just to give us a bit of a background about the proposed Mulgara Rock uranium mine.
Under the former Liberal government, they pushed through 4 environmental approvals before the 2017 state election. Kintyre actually was approved a little bit before, but just before the election, they approved the Yalira uranium mine in the goldfields up near Wiluna, the Wiluna uranium project over 2 lake systems, Lake Way and Lake Maitland, and then the Mulgara Rock project, which is about 240 kilometres northeast of Kalgoorlie. And they did this really, I think, to wedge the Labor government, who have a long-standing opposition to uranium mining. And so when the Labor government did come into power, one of the first things that they did was to reinstate a policy ban on uranium mining in WA, but said that they wouldn't open the state up to compensation claims by uranium companies, and that they would let those four approved projects go ahead with I think the belief that the uranium price was so low that none of the projects were viable. And so the kind of position we're in now is that each of those approvals had a clause in the conditions that said that they had to start mining within 5 years. Now, three of those four have not been able to meet that condition of what they call substantial commencement. So those three projects are now pretty much done and dusted, and we're calling on the state government to completely withdraw those approvals.
And so in terms of this Mulga Rock proposal, I mean, you know, given that it's 5 years from the end of 2016, it would be cutting it very close. How is it different from the other three? And is there more, I guess, potential and a more possible threat that this Mulga Rock project will go ahead?
Yeah, it's getting more and more concerning. The big question at the end of last year was, what is substantial commencement, and can Vimy prove that they have substantially commenced mining? And, you know, what's pretty disturbing here is that they strategically cleared land that was destructive, but we think not substantial. It was less than 4% of the total area that they needed to clear. It was in prime habitat for the endangered sandhill dunner, which we think is just so deeply irresponsible, because they were clearing some of the most valuable habitat for an endangered species. At the same time, the company, A, doesn't have the funding to start mining, and B, haven't even made a board-level decision that they will advance the project. And here they are wedging an anti-nuclear state government into allowing this mine to go ahead when they haven't even made a corporate decision that they're going to go ahead. So we made lots of arguments to the state government saying there's no way that this company has substantially commenced, no matter which way you look at it. And turns out the only way the government was looking at it was about clearing, land clearing. So we've been really disappointed that the state government has said, yes, this company has substantially commenced. We totally disagree, and we continue to oppose that view that the government has, that this project has substantially commenced. So the position we're in now is that the company, having met this milestone, is able to continue to develop a mine. The only thing holding it back is funding at the moment, and quite a few other approvals. So they still need a works approval from the Department of Environment. They still have a Sandhill Dunner Conservation Management Plan that they need approved by the federal government. And then there's a whole suite of licences and permits they need from the federal government to operate a nuclear facility, possess uranium and export uranium. So there's still a few of those things in the way, but the major barrier is funding. And today we've seen that they've put a trading halt on their shares, and they're talking to another company, Deep Yellow, about a merger, which would mean that they're pooling resources. There'd be a big chunk of money coming in from Deep Yellow, and that might help fund this mine getting off the ground. So we're pretty worried now about how quickly this project might develop.
Mia, I'd imagine most people who listen to this program, or at least listen to RTR, are aware of some of the dangers around uranium mining and nuclear power. But I guess in recent years, there's, you know, despite the fact that, as you've said previously, there's been a huge drop in the price of uranium and associated sort of materials, but there's been a little bit of a renewed push from some sectors around this idea that nuclear is an alternative to some fossil fuels, that it could be part of a solution for climate change and so forth. And I guess, you know, for people like yourself, I'm sure that's quite frustrating to hear those arguments. But can you, I guess, outline why you believe this particular project, this Mulga Rock project, and uranium mining in general here in Australia, or really anywhere, is sort of so detrimental to the environment and also to, I guess, our broader sort of social and political realities?
Sure. Well, there's a lot in there, but I guess to start with at the mine site, one of our biggest concerns around uranium mining is that the inability to properly rehabilitate those sites. So, you know, some people argue, well, you're taking the radiation out of the ground and chipping it off, so isn't that better? Well, no. When you mine uranium, what you leave behind is about 80% of the total radioactivity of the ore body, and that was once stable in the ground. And once it's dug up, processed and turned into liquid tailings, that waste is now bioavailable in our environment. And what we're seeing, what we have seen at uranium mines around the country is a failure of any company to properly rehabilitate and protect the environment from those tailings. So during operation, there's risks around exposure through dust. And then post-closure, there's risks of that tailings leaking into the environment. So we're deeply concerned about that at this site. What we're also worried about at this site is acid mine drainage. So there's something called potentially acid-forming rock at the site. That's the same as the issues at Rum Jungle, a former uranium mine, which has got both acid mine drainage and radiation pollution in the environment. So they're things that we're really worried about. We're also really worried about just general issues with mining that might happen at any site that would impact on the endangered sandhill dunnart, brush-tailed mulgara, the migratory rainbow bird eater,